listening to the Vibe Collective 89.5 CIUT, and this is Anand's ultimate show. My name is Mally, aka Docu Vixen.
Adrian, aka Orr. One of those days. Adrian Worrell, aka Griffin.
And Adnan Hussein, aka Badnan.
So, for our last show, I thought we would have a last freestyle to send you off to the East Coast.
I know. It's actually, it's beginning to wear on me. I started packing up boxes and stacking them up, and the cat's having a heart attack, and, and it's beginning to dawn on me that it's real now, right? The Toronto trip is ending. Yeah. At least this time around.
Yeah.
I'll be back.
You better believe it. Bearing goodies, I hope, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just I think the gravity of Canada emanates from Toronto, so everything kind of drifts
back. Hey, don't say that too loud, man. People listening in Calgary and London are going to be really upset.
I don't think they're going to. That's not something they can contest, really.
see that? He's saying that as he's leaving, right?
I
so
know.
He don't have to deal with the fallout. Like,
yep.
Well done. But I was hoping that maybe you could talk a bit about your process getting to this point. Because we're saying, oh, yeah, I know Adnan's going to Halifax. He got a job in Halifax. But, you know, you're not one to complain much on air. But maybe you can give listeners, people who are interested in entering the field that you're in, some of what you have experienced to get to where you are headed now.
You know, I actually, in many ways, I feel that academia is kind of a... It's kind of a scam in a lot of ways. And I feel because I get to do something that I absolutely love, that I'm obsessed about, that I'm really interested in, and then I also get to teach, which is so much fun. And the fact that someone is willing to pay me to do that is just, it blows my mind every day that someone is also willing to sign a paycheck to let me do this thing that I really love. And I think that's maybe the core of it, that if you don't really love it, it's a nasty field to be in because there's dead ends at every turn. And you might have a very supportive supervisor or unsupportive supervisor. You may have a supportive department, unsupportive department. It's really up in the air, and every person's experience is different because despite the fact that people keep talking about education being more and more like a factory, and in essence, it really is what you put into it and how you kind of design it yourself. And I think one of the problems with the ways that students are coming into school now is that they're coming in right after high school. And I think that you're not savvy enough to make the important decisions you need to make in college when you first walk into school. And I think like a couple years life experience, get out there, live, figure out what you want to do.
Well, especially nowadays, people are coming in, like when I was going to university a long time ago, I went in when I was 19. Mm-hmm. It's a little different than when you're 17.
Oh, yeah.
Those 2 years, like, make a difference. I don't know.
And you don't come in as green. You realize what things you want to do, don't want to do. You have a bit more, you're a bit more savvy. And then again, I think there's a break. People just go straight from sort of high school into undergrad, into their law program or whatever, or their master's or anything like that, and don't ever stop to take a breath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's the mistake, because you're not 100% sure. And it took, for me, it took becoming a lawyer to realize that I don't want to do this. And don't make that $100,000 mistake.
Oh, wow. So, you know, going from your journey from being a practicing lawyer to academia, and now you're kind of starting a sort of a new phase of that. Like, what was that like?
With law, I wasn't so much a practicing attorney as in what they have in American law schools is something called a third year practice rule, which is in your third year of law school, and in my case, in my third and fourth year, since I was doing my master's at the same time, I was practicing for 2 years, but under this exception in the law that lets you practice as a student to get sort of practical experience in the field before they throw you out into the formal practice field because I was actually at U of T doing my PhD when I took the bar. So it's kind of differently arranged that way. But I found that just generally the thing is about if you're interested in academia and it's really it's quite fun, but in many ways it's not quite the life of the mind that people think it is. It's still in many ways it's an industry in its own way, and you have to become savvy about it, and you have to learn about it, and you have to think about it, and sort of figure out like how am I marketable? Like if you want to study like third century women's hygiene practices, you better find some relevance, you know? and usually the relevance comes up in the strangest ways. Like you could find some kind of nutty health movement that is like third century hygiene practices only, you know, build a stronger body. And if you market it on the internet, maybe you can really make that go. But I think being relevant is important. And it also, even if you're studying something or working on something really obscure, if you can make it somehow relevant to people today, that helps a lot.
Yeah. So, in coming in is...
Hello.
Hello. Yay, you made it to the studio.
Always. I didn't have to get into any fights with anyone in any luxury vehicles.
Yeah, there is this, the parking lot here is really confusing, especially the one on this side, because it seems that there's not enough space to turn around if you back out improperly.
Right.
And so there's just people just stopping and confused and sort of getting out their cars and looking at it. And it's just like,
I can't believe you're taking her on, because she's fully disappointed she didn't have to cuss nobody out this time.
I did have someone in an SUV cut me off on the way here. I have an issue with people who have entitlement around vehicles.
But that's the point of getting an SUV, is to cut people off and let them say, like, look, I'm in this monster vehicle and there's nothing that you in your regular sized car can do about it. Like, that was one of the marketing points.
I do tell people that if I ever came down with a terminal disease and someone upset me enough, I will run my car into someone.
Oh, okay.
Ouch.
Yeah. I just hope it's not me on the bicycle right next to you.
You know what? It was really interesting. I was thinking about you and one other person, Complex, are the only reason why I have compassion for people on bikes in the city.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah.
Real talk.
Well, I do my best to always, like, I stop at red lights and stuff like that. And the only thing that I let slide is inside street stop signs.
Okay.
I will do a rolling stop on those.
So you do admit that there are cyclists in Toronto who are just ridiculous.
They make it more dangerous for everyone else. They're crazy. And I wish that they would be more aggressive with ticketing on cyclists, especially on red lights, because they make it unsafe for drivers, because drivers operate on a degree of predictability.
Right.
And as a cyclist, you also operate on a high degree of predictability of all the other traffic. And if someone is behaving in an unpredictable manner, they're making the entire road more dangerous for everyone.
Perfect. Now I can just take off my headphones and go to sleep.
So I wanted to go back to your point where you're talking about academia and like making your I guess studies relevant, and going to back where people go back to back from degree to degree and there's no break. So how are you supposed to, if you don't have that time to actually experience sort of, how could you make your studies relevant?
Yeah, that's the thing, that I think that's the high cost you pay, that if you just rip through one field after another and you just one degree after another and you end up on the flip side with like three or four letters after your name and not a lot of practical experience, you're not an interesting person. And so when you go out and you go for interviews and stuff like that, I have to say that all of the interviews that I did for academic positions were an evaluation of whether or not this person would be interesting to have around in our department. That's the question they were asking themselves. And if you come in and you're like, but I know so much stuff about Foucault, and they're just like, yeah, you're going to be that guy at the party. And as opposed to if you're like, oh, I know a lot about just like some fun thing that's going on in the world, something relevant that's going on, have a good discussion. I think it kind of keeps you bonded to reality. And also when you're meeting your colleagues for the first time, these people have been in academia usually a lot longer and kind of have developed their own, and everyone realizes that academia and talking about this stuff, life of the mind stuff, is their jobs. And so they have cultivated an interest in other stuff like canoeing or whatever, or bicycling. And that's the stuff that they want to talk about when they're on their off time, when they're figuring out whether or not this person can be a colleague. And I think that gets neglected entirely too often. When people are figuring out whether or not they want to do academia, they're like, yeah, well, I'm passionate and I like studying this thing and I've learned the languages, so I obviously can do it and I'll get a job at the end. Maybe.
There's much more to it than that, of course.
Well, I mean, in every generation, you're going to have these characters who are just superstars, right? Like, who really know their stuff inside out, who can read like 6 and 7 languages, who can just do it. And those people are never, I mean, they know who they are. They don't have anything to worry about. Those kind of characters are always going to be fine. But for the rest of us who have to put in the hours.
You only know 3 or 4 languages, right?
but I mean, that's baseline. You're not crossing the threshold without that.
I'm sorry, where?
In academia.
Oh, in academia. Oh, okay. Yeah,
this is clarified.
Yeah. In my field, you're going to have...
And Pig Latin does not count as an additional language.
No. Not normally, no. Okay. It just depends. Again, if you make it relevant, and if you're like, I found these 4 texts in Pig Latin, they're very important.
Do a PhD in Pig Latin, starting it tomorrow.
What languages do you know?
Well, I grew up speaking Urdu, and that usually means I can understand and speak Hindi as well. I know how to understand Punjabi and Bengali, and I can speak French and Spanish, and my German reading is okay. I learned Latin in school. I picked up Swahili when I was in East Africa.
We're past 5, right?
Yeah. So
yeah. So that's, and then I studied a bit of Greek. Because it was neat.
You know, there's a whole bunch of languages out there I heard you mention. Like, you're kind of slacking, actually.
Only 5?
And actually, like, Arabic I can read, and Farsi, too. So.
No Mandarin?
Nope.
You're not serious about life.
Enough Cantonese to order food, ask for hot sauce and cold water with ice.
Korean, Vietnamese, no.
Nope. Vietnamese, you can pass in French. You don't need Vietnamese when I was there.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was just like there was pressure in my family to learn this kind of stuff because it was, I think my parents had an interesting approach to education in which they kind of prioritized stuff like language. And language is important. And so anyone who could teach me any bit of language, they would sort of put pressure on them to kind of get me engaged in that fashion. And as a child, you're so porous that you can just absorb this stuff. And it sits dormant in your memory that people will be like, oh, I studied French for like 6 years when I was a kid and I've forgotten everything. If you start up again, it'll come rushing back. Yeah, and it's crazy how fast that stuff returns. And just, start watching children's cartoons in French and you'll understand everything. And it just builds on that.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Can we talk about the U.S. government tracking people's calls?
Yeah, we
can talk about that.
As someone who I'm pretty sure has had their phone tapped before, I find it kind of silly that, so I always have extremely mundane conversations with everyone normally anyway. And so then I don't really know how to ratchet it up for people listening. And I'm like, well, if you're listening, I just...
Like, the purple crow flies at midnight. Like, you gotta just start those kind of random phrases from time to time.
Maybe when I was in college. Nowadays, I just like to keep it simple for them. I'm like, what I mean by the box is my computer.
I'm just wondering, you know, first of all, what extent to which the Canadian government is doing this? Because my assumption is that some of this has to be happening in Canada as well.
I generally, the way I think of it is Canada typically goes along with whatever America is doing on some level, you know.
These days, yeah.
Yeah, and with Chrétien's out of office, you know, right? So. Yeah. You know, Harper is going to go along with whatever they're saying, I would imagine. You know, I don't know for sure, but that's how I think about it. So mm-hmm. Once this is happening in the States, I think it's happening in Canada too. And it's kind of like, I mean, I think the real question we should be asking ourselves is if we can't trust Batman with that kind of power, like if you saw the last Batman movie, they were like, you know, this is too much information for people to have. Why could we trust Barack Obama or Stephen Harper with it? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's my kind of frame of reasoning.
I guess my question is, do we trust that they're only tracking the calls, not listening to calls? I mean, on that massive level. I mean, we know they're listening to some people's calls, non-Americans.
I don't know. For me, I'll say I ran with a lot of paranoid people from a early age. And, like, I saw things like something called the Friendship Network before Facebook in, like, 96. And they're showing us on CNN. They're like, yeah, well, we record people's calls and we don't actually listen to them. But we just have our computers search for key phrases in them.
Yeah.
And so, sure. And so I was kind of like, okay, this was happening in 1996.
Yeah.
Then
they've been doing it for a long time.
It's been happening for a while. Yeah. So I look at this and I'm like, okay, whatever, you know. So.
And if they're tracking that many calls, what are they going to do with it, right? Like, it's a lot of calls and a lot of text messages.
But you just develop computer programs to do it. It's not algorithms. Like someone's sitting there listening.
And there's ways to get around some of this stuff, too. Like, when there were a lot of protests going on in China, there was a push to develop these programs, and one of them is called Silent Phone, and another one's called Silent Text, which you can install, which is a very difficult-to-break encryption, which you can encrypt your outgoing calls and your text messages and stuff with. Now, the thing is, does that put you into a higher risk category the second you start using silent phone and silent text? Probably.
Probably. Like, this person's using silent text, and that's how you get flagged, right?
Some of those things. Yeah, so
but,
then,
I mean, if you're already flagged.
So, yeah, if you're using those programs, just a heads up, you're probably also, your mundane calls to your doctor about your stool are being recorded as well, so
I'm also curious if this has changed people's perceptions of the one and great only Barack Obama, right? Like, because he admitted, like, this is a continuation of the Bush legacy. And I like Tumblr. Tumblr's my thing. I like to look at pictures on Tumblr. I don't read anything.
They were bought by Yahoo the other month.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
Well, but to me, it goes, like, to the whole politics of investment, right? Because I've been in, you know, conversations, I was going to say argument, conversations with people where it's like, you're clearly wrong. Like, there's been, like, just, like, pages of counter evidence against your point.
Yes.
And they're just going to sit and say, well, I still believe that. And it's like, it's a similar thing with, I imagine, with Obama, you know, where it's kind of like, there's this great emotional investment in this figure. And you can now produce all kinds of evidence and all kind of, and people aren't necessarily going to change their views, which is not to say he's the worst thing out or anything like that, but just the way that, I guess, in some sense, how I don't say manipulation, that's a little harsh, but like how certain type of calculations are done, you know. Once you have this great emotional investment in something, you know, emotion trumps reason, you know, like 9 times out of 10. So as things come down the line, people aren't likely going to want to reverse that emotional investment in everything they've already used to justify that. And so as things get worse and worse, they're more likely to dig in deeper opposed to say, oh, you know what, I was wrong about that.
Right.
Yeah, I also find with Obama that he was, in so many ways, he was an important figure to have elected. And that's kind of what he represents now, is that he's an important stage in American race relations and American, like, history and stuff like that. But as far as the role of president and what a president can and can't do, I think we have to have you have to think about that very seriously. Like, you're not going to have a good president anymore, not with the way that the system is set up, not with the way that that lobbying works, not with the way that the understandings of administrative agency work in things like the office of the president. It's just the role is not the great leader role, and if people are looking for the great leader, they're not going to find it in the president. Yeah. But at the same time, I think what Barack represents in his presence as president is important, and that is an important stage in American history. And I think that it kind of, maybe if you're a real serious pessimist, you could say that you could take the highest minded person who's had a lot of interesting life experience, who is a person of color, and you can put them in the White House and they'll become the exact same thing that a Bush would become. Like, so it's kind of a gibbering rich boy idiot, and you can put him in office and he turns into a monster. You can take this, like, liberal brown guy, stick him in office and he becomes a monster. It's like the office corrupts.
Yeah, certainly. The things you have to respond to and the people who are on your back, and I could see how, you know, someone could go into a situation relatively idealistic and then have to respond to things that turns them not so idealistic. You know? But I really like your point about they separating that. This is an important point in kind of a race relations in American history, opposed to the policy things and even just the presidency itself, like how power is being kind of consolidated in that position. Power, some people say lack of power or whatever that is, that the job itself has changed. Mm-hmm. And having this figure coincide with that change is kind of disarmed a lot of people in certain ways, or distracted them from looking at, you know, those kind of like policy constitutional issues. Yeah.
I think I'm just interested in this idea that it's changed race relations. In, I guess, the when he was elected the first time, it was very important, right? Mm-hmm. But at this particular point, you know, knowing that he has taken on some of the past president's policies, and this radio station has publicized through Democracy Now, you know, the killing of Abdulrahman Al-Waqi, the 16-year-old son of Anwar Al-Waqi, who was alleged to be a part of Al-Qaeda. And basically what has been admitted to by, I can't remember the person's title within the U.S. government, that, you know, basically the 16-year-old was killed because he was the son of this guy, right? Like, there was mm-hmm. nothing. And I'm just saying, like, where in that space, just because this person is, you know, I don't know how Barack Obama self-identifies. Does he identify as black? Does he identify as mixed race? Okay. As this black man in power, if he's doing the same thing, why is it significant if he's just repeating the same things, right? So I guess for me, I'm just like, meh. And that's why I'm like, Tumblr / Yahoo. I'm just like, I mean, I don't care. I don't care. Like, any day now, and looking at, like, the kind of things that have been said around this case is, like, if you are not American, you can be targeted, right? So that means that we as Canadians can be targeted. You know, Indigenous folks within this country can be targeted by the Canadian government. You know, it's just it's, I don't know. I guess I'm just upset.
And that can get,
I guess, overwhelmed by, like, yeah.
I guess the story was really important for me. Yeah. Like, I just, everything I could listen to, and I want to see, like, the, there's a documentary about it, right? Like, I'm like, this kid goes to look for his father and gets killed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we need to go to a break.
Oh.
Okay, we have a little bit more.
I mean, this, it just depends on how, I think, also you structure your understanding and your notion of justice. Mm. And in many times, historically, human beings have thought about justice applying to more than just merely the person who's doing the act. And so, for example, in Chinese history, used to have collectivized justice. So if you committed a crime, your family members and up to 7 generations of your family members could be punished for that crime if it was severe enough, because it was thought you had to eradicate the root that caused this, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but we have come so strongly to believe that the notion of justice is tied to the treatment of the individual nowadays, that we are offended when we see that not playing out. But in many ways, the perpetrators of this kind of stuff are most frequently going to be the champions of individualized justice. So people like the U.S. will go into a place and say, we're going to drone bomb this area and eradicate thousands of civilians for the purpose of killing the odd Taliban guy. And that's justifiable because they were the people standing in the orbit of this character. Or alternatively, like the French did it in Algeria, where if you watch the film... Battle of Algiers, thank mm-hmm. you. If you watch that film, Guillermo Poncorvo has captured the fact that, like, when the French couldn't get the person that they wanted, they would go and they would destroy an entire city block. They would torture and murder an entire people in the city block to say, well, he came out of your community, and this is the price that you have to pay when this happens. And the French won the war on terror in Algeria. They were successful, but they had to become monsters to win it, mm-hmm. right? And so that's what I think that the U.S. has kind of been teetering on the whole time, that they wanting to be the champions of justice, the ray of light, the city on the hill, but at the same time willing to murder people to make that possible and to bury those corpses deep, and never quite reflecting on what the costs of that are.
Yeah, and it's a tactic that goes, it's kind of like a gangster tactic in a sense. Like, okay, if we can't get you, we're going to get your kids, mm-hmm. right? And it's something that goes far back. I remember hearing about that in terms of, like, plantation slavery, where you'd have somebody who, you know, say, you know, damn it, I'm not working in this mill anymore. And they decide to, like, you know, jam it up in some sense. And they wouldn't just kill that one person. They would kill everybody to send a message like, if you do that, this is what happens. You know, and to create a create an environment where people are going to self-police, where it's like, okay, well, if someone is acting in these kind of ways or hold these kind of views, let's just put them up front because we know what's going to happen if this person, you know, isn't found in time, all of us are going to get it. Right? And so that's one of the kind of psychological tactics that's cool. It goes pretty far back in... You know, I do believe that, you know, the Americans are engaging in that, and it's, you know, colonial tactic, and a lot of what they're doing is a type of neocolonialism.
Right.
Okay, I think we're going to go to break, and you are listening to The Vibe Collective. This is CIUT 89.5.
The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
And you're listening to The Vibe Collective. This is 89.5 FM. And yeah, we're like to say that shout outs to Jamias, who's enjoying her
New York.
In New York.
I think she had to just throw in there, like, you know, I don't know if I will, but I might go to an Erykah Badu Yasin Bey concert.
We have to make the distinction, though. She's not in New York. She's in Brooklyn.
Yeah, sure.
Shout out to Brooklyn.
And
yeah,
so definitely. I want to shout out to our tech,
London.
Yay. Yay. Thanks for teching for us. So awesome. So, yeah, like what we were saying before, we were talking about...
The psychological tactics.
Tactics of the empire.
I think the labor of oppression is... You know, the oppressor can't do all the work. You have to induce people to self-oppress if you're going to be any kind of successful oppressor.
Yeah.
Right? You can't be always bopping people on the head every damn day.
Yeah.
Takes away from your champagne and caviar time.
And that is, it's been consistent in especially amongst, you see it from every stage. You see it in the schoolroom, right? Like if someone doesn't tell me who threw that, everyone has to stay five extra minutes, you know, and so you kind of set up a scenario in which you want people to out each other because they saw it. You know that somebody out there saw it.
Somebody knows.
But that is extremely unjust, right? Like, and so you're kind of hardwiring people.
Well, I don't know that that's unjust.
How
right?
is that not unjust?
The same thing.
I think that when we look at collective responsibility and we know that someone's done something wrong, we have a responsibility to work in a way to resolve that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And define a way of meeting out justice, right? So children need to be encouraged in that way. But when we're talking about adults, I feel like, and there's a power relationship, I think that's a different situation from saying, you know, you have 5 minutes to tell me. Because I think in that way, you're teaching children, one, about how to conduct themselves, and two, I mean, there is some justification to self-policing, right?
Yeah, but I think you set up a scenario of injustice when you do that. Like, I think it's quite different if you were to say, someone threw something at me, therefore you all stay 10 extra minutes, versus if you don't tell me who threw that at me, you all stay 10 extra minutes, and the person who threw that stays a half an hour.
So I'm just flashing back to, like, that was like a regular thing in our elementary school.
Yeah, that was normal.
And it was always a calculation. It's like, okay, do we want the detention, or do we want the person who did it in their crew to beat the shit out of everybody? You know, because that was... Because, you know, the people who do that, they often have a certain kind of clout in, you know, they're making a statement in terms of doing that, right? So if you rat on them, recess is not going to be the same anymore, right?
Yeah.
No stitching.
No stitching, right? Yeah. So it's always one of these kind of calculations. Like, okay, you know what? We'll just take the 10-minute detention because teachers are going to be there when this guy decides to hit me with a brick on the way home or something like that, right?
Yeah.
That was part of the calculation. But, like, I mean, as a... former educator, or, you know, whatever my situation is, I remember being in situations like that and purposely saying, okay, I don't want to recreate these power dynamics, you know, because you do prepare people, you legitimize certain things if you reinforce them in the classroom, right? But that said, there were times where I had a class and I'm like, okay, you know what? Nobody talks to that kid. Like, you know? And it was like, because...
So you knew who it was and you decided to take that type of...
It was a situation where, like, in every single class... this one person would just start disrupting things. Okay. And, like, really charismatic, really funny. And like, you wouldn't get anything done, you know. Then you have the principal on you. So it's like, you know what? This person doesn't want to learn anything. They don't care if they get in trouble. If you're talking to this person, you're going to get the same thing they get, because we know what's going to happen. I wouldn't do that now at this age. It was early in my career, but I could see how somebody would be like, okay, fine, this is what we're going to do at a point of frustration. But at the same time, counterbalance with the idea of we reinforce, you know, certain power dynamics that, again, the dominant culture later plays on to justify certain things.
Right.
I mean, we were having a discussion last week outside of the show, and I said I wasn't going to have any children, and I won't get into what that topic was about, because that was a very lovely conversation. But, you know, thinking about, like, the ways in which I'm changing the subject, I think, so we can go back. The ways in which we define educational spaces for our children, like when you talked about the charismatic child in the class, you know, I automatically think about, you know, my godson who is super bright, and he finishes his work, and he likes to talk. He's a social being, right? Oh. And what kind of spaces do we, I don't know if that was the case of the child that you're talking about. No.
And I mean, you know, to defend myself a bit, I was kind of like, okay, well, you know, you could have the last 5 minutes of class. It's your time. You know, I saw that on, like, someone said that Martin Lawrence, that's how he got started or something. Oh, okay. I'm like, you know, I wasn't like I just,
Something.
Because he would also show up to class and say, okay, your last 5 minutes is yours. So I tried a number of compromises throughout the year. And after a while, I was like, you know what? This is what's going down. Yes. But like, in terms of like you were saying, in terms of creating these educational spaces, we definitely need to be more flexible.
Please do not tweet any hate mail to the Vibe Collective. I love educators. I love them. And I know that educators are doing the best that they can within, you know, the spaces in which they have to teach. But I think...
Yeah, not always.
Always.
Here I am trying to bring balance. And y'all are like...
We're bringing the balance. We're bringing the
It ain't always sweet. There are people doing great things, but it isn't always sweet.
But I think what has been very sad for us to see in this generation is that, so if you look 200 years ago, people were out there struggling for the right to be represented, for the right for representative government. Mm-hmm. They were fighting to have rights against the state. And that's like the setup of the early human rights regimes was all about what the state is not allowed to do to you. Mm-hmm. And so those were, like, in many ways they were structured as negative rights, right? So the state cannot. And then there were positive rights, like the I am entitled to healthcare, so stuff like that. And now what we're swinging back towards is we're going to have to start demanding negative rights again. So we're going to have to, I think we as a peoples are going to have to engage our governments in this conversation in terms of what constitutes the rights of a human being, and what does that human being then have an entitlement to? Because even if someone is going to say, I'm going to listen in on your phone calls or something like that, as opposed to getting seriously offended, I would like to get everybody together and say, do you mind that? And what we found increasingly is in places like the U.S., people were lining up to sign their rights away. They were like, if you prevent a terror bombing in this city, I will sign away the rights to free and frank phone calls, and I will sign away the rights to have my emails checked. And this was the real tragedy of 9/11 is you saw people lining up to give these hard-fought, these rights on which people bled for away. And that was mind-blowing to me, and that, I think, was the greatest tragedy of America post-September 11th, was this farce that took place. And I think the reflex hasn't happened yet. People haven't gotten upset yet. But Americans, I think, as well as Canadians, are hardwired to finding that stuff wrong. But they can't live in this state of perpetual stress and fear, and I think that the government is, and the corporatized media has done such an excellent job of keeping people in this state of constant anxiety that you're willing to give up a lot when you're in a state of anxiety. Mm-hmm. Just think about if you're in a relationship where someone is making you constantly uncomfortable and anxious, you become less of a person in the context of that relationship. You're willing to accept less than complete love, less than complete dedication, less than complete respect from a person, and that's what we've allowed to happen in the case of our governments, is that we're living in a state of such intense stress, I think, brought on by all these other factors, by fear of the other, by fear of the way that we forget the thing that we should also perhaps be afraid of is the guard who we keep handing bigger and bigger guns to.
So very well put.
And I feel like there's a lot of, you know, communities within Canada that already feel like that, you know, in terms of especially those who don't consider themselves Canadians, Indigenous communities, Indigenous community members who don't feel like that, you know, it's that constant fear of lording over you, and not even, I guess, not in terms of giving away rights, but the ways in which the Indian Act monitors and regulates Indigenous folks' lives at this particular point. So,
And it's interesting how technology is being used and not used. Like a point I made earlier today on another show, Region Radio, it was, do we even need representatives in the same way anymore? Like, I mean, if you have the technology that can be monitoring all these phone calls, isn't there much more capacity for participatory democracy in which, as opposed to having, you know, every 4 years you vote someone else to go and represent, you can vote on every issue if you so chose. You know, you don't necessarily need a representative.
Right? I think we need the House of Commons. I think we should do away with the Senate.
Yeah, I think maybe
the Senate we don't need.
I think maybe for the culture of politics to develop, you need some kind of government. But at the same time, I think on a daily basis, if you set aside like the first Sunday of every month, or the first Monday of every month, and every citizen could go and vote online. And you had like a 4-hour block when you had the hot issues presented and citizens could go and vote online. They entered their data and all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And if you had that, that is workable, right? That's workable today.
I mean, they can tap, you know, millions and billions of phone calls. I mean, clearly the capacity is there. It's like, but do we want, I'm not saying we, do they want people, the citizens, engaged in their politics in that kind of way, you know?
Do you think more people take advantage of the franchise if that was the case?
If you could have an immediate effect on particular policies, I think you would have, I don't know, there's always going to be people who would be like, it doesn't matter. You're always going to have the cynics and the apathetic types. But I do think it, like, even what it would take to keep people even reasonably informed to perform their civic duties, a lot would have to change. And I think people would be in engagement.
I'm just thinking about the petition that went up about the Walmart in Kensington, and I'm like, that's a clear example where people came out. I was like, say a word, you know?
I mean, they had like 43,000.
I think it's more than that.
That's the last I checked.
Yeah, well, it's just that when you have things like the online petitions and it makes it very easy, right? So you've got your point click activism and stuff like that, which you can engage in as well. But I find from a participatory side of government, we have gotten very far away from this traditional concept of citizenship has duties. Like when you said civic duties, that's kind of an important way to reflect on it as well. Because, I mean, if you're looking at like Athenian style democracy, they were going to say, or maybe even if you're looking at Sparta, you're like, you are not a citizen unless you're a soldier as well. Mm-hmm. A soldier makes you a citizen. There's people who live here, and then there's people who become citizens through service. And we've gotten completely away from that model. You exist as a citizen just merely by existing in a space for enough time, or being born in a space.
It's right now, it's corporatized, so you're a citizen if you're a consumer.
Right.
That's your service.
Right, and that and service to the economy, I think, has never been enough. Like I start to sound like a fascist when I start talking about this stuff. But in honesty, like when we were discussing earlier the kind of experience you could give kids, I would love an experience in which instead of just going from high school into university, that you did 2 years of civil service. And I don't care in what capacity you do it, that you work for an NGO or you work for a government wing or you work for something like that, and the government insures salary for you for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then you go to college. And you work in whatever capacity, whatever you're interested in. I think that kind of life experience would be amazing. Like I'm not for mandatory army service. I think that's lunacy. I think on the other hand, having 2 years of engaged
public service,
public or even something private. And if for people who are worried about like that they need to make money for their families or they need to be working for their families, this is guaranteed employment at a guaranteed wage And I think like that makes a lot of sense to me. And also, I like ideally in a perfect world, if I was the dictator, right? Like I would set
perfect
it up. That
wait, stop. Perfect world dictator. Continue.
You know, when it boils down to it, the situation for greatest justice is created when it's done through the model and ideal of one person, right? But we're always comfortable with this because we theologize it, because it's like, oh, if God is the perfect, then right. I think we're hardwired to think that we're kind of comfortable with that, right? That the perfect world is not deliberation, is not deliberative. The perfect world is dictation, is orders. But in that kind of a system, I would say that you have to leave home too for 2 years, and you have to get out there unless you've got a compelling reason to stay, like a sick parent or something like that. But I think that 2 years of service to kind of attach you to the country in some way, that in a meaningful way, and also that's something which, if you were to ask people like immigrants and things like that they would say that they would do that. If you were told you come to a country and you're admitted onto an immigration track and you get to have 2 years guaranteed employment, you build meaningful skills, it's
you get experience automatically.
Yeah. But again, like, that's my pipe dream, my fascism.
My fascist pipe dream. But I think it's interesting, like, these conversations where it's like, how do we reorganize civic or state processes, you know, in light of technological developments, in light of social developments in recent history? And ideas like that, I think are very important, you know, in terms of really thinking about what our possibilities are. Because right now, I think one of the issues is, again, like a crisis of imagination and this kind of apathy of, you know, the populace. And it's like, I can certainly understand why we're there. I'm there most of the time, you know what I mean? So I can definitely get with it. But it's, how do we, going forward, as our rights keep getting whittled away, as power consolidates in these, you know, these semi-figurehead positions or whatever, how do we reclaim some of that, and what's our vision, you know, and how do these things work? And so, like, the idea of, you know, changing the way education works, the way change the way civic duty is conceived, the way that electing works, all these things are on the table, and hopefully can energize a discussion where it's like people kind of find a reason to care again,
right?
And then also, like, the crisis of, like, just integration of, like, the actual system itself. Like, it's coming out that, you know, like, every level of our government right now is, you know, going through some kind of scandal. So right. The fact that we're not even able to, like, imagine that we can reorder that, you know what I mean? Like, it's sort of, oh, well, like, let's just keep it moving.
What are you gonna do, politicians? Are gonna be politicians.
Yeah, they're just, that's just the way they are. And yeah, it seems like a major crisis right now.
I think that there are people challenging it, but I think there are also people who are working from without, right? They're just, like, not concerned about all of that, right? And I it's problematic on a level because the world still goes on, the politics still goes on, and this leads to, you know, not just, you know, the desecration of places, but the desecration of people, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it is a balance in which people who work from within and without have to take into consideration. And we are, I feel like, we're hitting a critical mass in terms of what's happening environmentally and what's happening to people as well, right? Was there another fire in China in a garment factory?
Well, it's Cambodia. There was something like a Nike factory. People, there's an uprising there.
The Cambodia fire happened maybe like a month ago. No,
I thought something happened last week.
Well, it's
well,
just
maybe it but was another one. I don't know. Yeah.
I think increasingly what we're going to find is that, like, and when we talk about the very real fear of corporatization of the world, I think we're talking in a meaningful way, because the way that corporations function is that their purpose is to make money. Their purpose isn't to save the environment. These are all what a corporate lawyer would call ultra vires concerns, right? These are these additional things that these guys can get involved with, but are not part of their central mandate.
Or if they do get involved, they try to monetize it.
in some way or the other, right? That should, again, it makes us nervous when there's issues that we can't have a money-oriented perspective on when it comes to things like the tar sands. It can't be just about economics. Mm-hmm. Like this, and especially that I think as we move forward, the issues like the environment are going to become increasingly important, which we and I know I say this repeatedly, but I don't think it can be left to any one government. It cannot be left to the government which dominates the space over that land to handle how this land gets treated. Mm-hmm. Because increasingly, we need to start thinking of ourselves as globalized creatures, and we need to start thinking ourselves more sort of in an organic fashion as a community. And I think when you don't do that, it becomes very dangerous. And for, like, a lot of ideologues are saying that this is the problem with atheistic style liberalism, is mm-hmm. that it's not, there's no sense of connection between people, and that this is what in a lot of the theorists that I read now, granted, these some of them don't come up with the best solutions to this problem, but in other ways the lament which they have about the way that the system works is very real, that there's no sense of, there's no notion of the good, there's no shared notion of the good, there's no mm-hmm. shared notion of what connects us, there's no spiritual link between human beings, and that when you sever all of those things and you leave us just drifting in the ether, and what matters most to you is whether or not you can pay for your drink at the end of the night or be able to pay for your rent, then I think you're in a very scary space, and it's very lonely, and money is deeply isolating, and it's terrifying when mm-hmm. that's the connection you have between two people, is whether or not everyone's paying their due, and that's, I think it's sad and scary.
Oh yeah, but I would imagine that's part of the ideology, kind of the capitalistic ideology, right? Like mm-hmm. that's how you can have capitalism work, is by creating these kind of severances and these kind of subtle redirections to, if it's national or local or global capital, right? And yeah. So you know, it's your last show, so I gotta like bring everything out. So here you are talking, Adnan, about we need to have this transnational government, and yet the UN, you have no love for the UN.
I have no time for the UN.
Five-minute rant.
Yeah, I needed to have. I need to hear the UN rant one more time.
So
now let's go.
Okay, I'll have to say one thing. That my one of my uncles is giving a talk at the UN. I think he gave it last week on the 100th anniversary of Tagore, about this book of his that came out, and he was talking about the unity of humanity and the interconnectedness of humanity, and I just, the UN just, it doesn't do it for me, because I think it came out of an era of colonialism. Mm. And I think that stain has never rubbed off, because it's still run like a gang. Like, you've got these big five guys who you have to go clear everything with. You've got your Security Council kind of like, it's rigged. The system is very badly rigged. And I think the number of bad outcomes from the UN have shown us that this is a dead letter. And absolutely, it's important to have a world governing body, and one that actually has teeth, not this like toothless, ragged, horrible corpse of a monster that just rules over.
I just, there's the line. Yes. Yeah.
Not a fan of the UN.
He built up slowly, but he got there. He got there, yeah, folks. He got there.
I really think it's a mistake for us to put our energies and efforts and even hope into something which is so pointless as the UN, barring UNICEF. UNICEF is always the exception. Is always the exception, because UNICEF does their stuff and they do it right.
So, I mean, my only recollection of UNICEF right now is collecting money when I was a kid at Halloween.
And you turned it in, right? You didn't?
Of course I did. Mm. All those pennies. Mm. Yeah.
Word.
But aren't there other arms of the UN, the ones doing stuff around, you know, AIDS and supporting women, that you think is
beneficial? But this is the language of someone who's been abused, right? They're like, but he doesn't always hit me when he gets home, so it should be okay, right? Like, he doesn't always insult the way I look, so maybe we should forgive him. And it's like, no, this is a mistake. This is an abusive relationship that you're in. You need to get out. There's someone better out there for you.
I guess thinking about the conversation that we had maybe a couple months ago or a couple weeks ago, talking about you, in reference to you saying, you know, a globalized system, or thinking about ourselves as global citizens, is important for the success for our world, but understanding that localized movements is what's going to make us. I'm thinking about how do we both be local citizens in ways in which that we can be global citizens. And I think I made some sort of point. I don't remember. Jemiah said, you know, people in other worlds will have local systems too, and they'll figure it out. But the intermediary time between that just seems very.
Well, I mean, you have to, if you look at the major movements that have been kind of changing the spectrum in the last like 2 or 3 years, right? So things are going on in the Middle East, the Arab Spring, and other, I don't like the term, but anyway, that stuff, what's happening in Turkey today, the fact that that news is getting out, it's not, you don't need a UN declaration to say that this is something important that's taking place. Twitter and Facebook and Reddit and other places like that are getting this news out to people, and people are seeing and people are reflecting on it. People are talking about it. There's a buzz about it. That does more than any UN declaration can ever do. And also it spreads the news in a way which is meaningful for people, that they can see the very real tragedies taking place on the ground. And I think that personalization of tragedy is something that the internet can do in a way that no other medium that we've encountered can really do.
But do you feel like the apathy that I think I see in terms of the social networking sites? I mean, you could vote on something, you could post something, you could comment on it, but like actually doing the work, like it's really great that this petition for the Walmart in Kensington reached over 50,000, and then we had 400 and something people out at City Hall to reinforce that, right? And that's a clear example of it working. But the spaces in which, you know, repost, you know, Trayvon Martin's accused alleged killers, I don't even remember his name, is back in court, right? Like, it's just like, how do we actually go into communities and translate that? Yeah. I don't know how the three of you feel. Like, is it just like, I'm gonna point and click?
No, but there is compassion fatigue, right, as well, that I think you will reach a point in which you can't click one more link, and you can't like read one more thing, and that's fine. But then know where your energies are getting directed towards. Like, have your issues which you take a stand on, and then you push hard on those. Like, I care about Kensington, but I'm not going to put a lot of effort into saving the way Kensington looks. Like, I like it the way it is now, but that's not where my energy will go. My energy will go towards something different. And I am comfortable leaving the good work of Kensington to the people who really care about it. And I trust them and I respect them. And then but my energy might go towards a democratization movement or in Turkey, for example, like for this week. Like, my energy might go towards that, whereas I'm going to allow people to focus on a local issue in a manner which is kind of important to them as well. And I tend to have that bias as well, that I think local issues should be more important. The reason why I've become so interested in Turkey is that I've found that so many people are defending the government's actions, saying that these people are a rabble, and I find that really fascinating. When you're seeing the consequence of people being tear gassed, people being beaten up, and people are like, no, the government's justified in doing this. This is necessary.
Again, it goes back to that kind of like keeping people in this abused mentality state, where it's kind of like, oh, well, what are you going to do? Like, you know, you're going to say,
you're a bad citizen for me.
How bad the government is. You know, a lot of people just,
you need to be punished.
A lot of people just have this reflex where it's like, you know what, side with the winner. You know, it's like, whoever looks like they're going to win, you side with them and you think how they think. Yeah. Or else you're going to be the other person on that side of that rubber bullet. So, like, you know, a lot of times you see that reaction. I want to get back to Turkey because I don't know what's going on there. And typically anything that has to do with, like, you know, quote unquote Middle East and corporate media, and I don't read Arabic, I don't trust it, right? So I don't know anything, I'm not going to listen to
they
it, right?
They speak Turkish.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, even you're going to get more likely to get a... Well, fine, I mean, Molly, thanks.
It's a problem, right? Like, where do you go for your news? And if you exclusively read stuff on WikiLeaks, you will become a conspiracy theory nut. Like, you will go crazy just reading WikiLeaks. And then, or if alternatively all your news comes from Al Jazeera, you have to remember at the same time that Al Jazeera is hosted by a king, right? So, like, don't forget this, that they've probably got a stake in maintaining kingly rule.
A certain kind of illusion.
Yeah, so
it's being aware of the biases, right?
Yeah, and then but to be aware of that, you have to have a good liberal arts education, you know, and kind of an engaged education. I think you just have to, I don't know, like, I think this is the limit of what you're allowed to say on radio, right? But you have to seen some shit to, like, understand how the world works.
True enough.
And if you haven't, it's just the world will just, like, wash over you, will pass you by. And I think that
you're still in a bubble, right?
Yeah. And unless you tasted injustice, you don't know what it feels like, you know? And the kind of injustice you'll taste when you have to stay 5 extra minutes after class is not as bitter as the kind you have to face when, like, even silly things. Like, I found that sometimes the apartment hunt with a name like mine is difficult. And it's, and I get really irritable about it, but I, but there's no confirmation on the other side, right? Like, no one is saying that, no, I don't want no Sayyid Hussein living in my apartment, right? But, and they're not telling me that, and so I have no idea whether that's happening. All I know is I'm sending out a lot of requests for information, and very few come trickling back. And then when my partner does the exact same thing, she'll get a lot of information, and I'm sort of like, okay, there's
something going on here.
So there's something up, but is this really what I'm feeling? Is this the bitter taste of injustice? I just have a lack of information here, so.
Yeah.
But I mean, the point I wanted to make earlier was also about protest fatigue, about compassion fatigue, but like we often think that protest looks like people in the streets, you know? And I think there is something behind, like, you know, the kind of like clicktivist type of things, like I clicked on that link and I did my part, you know? But it's also the thinking that the only way that we can affect change is by going down to wherever and letting and making noise and doing such, doing that thing. It's useful, but you know, I've always been the fan of like, don't support the beast that's trying to eat you, you know, in a sense. So it's like, if you don't want Walmart in your area, stop shopping at Walmart.
Yeah,
you know, to a degree, or you know, do things to try to discourage that, because that's what, that's the language they understand is the money, right?
So and Walmart is a difficult one. It's one that I struggle with a lot, because I find that rhetoric against Walmart tends to take on an elitist flair a lot of times.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about like Walmart, it caters to populations who are thrilled to have it coming in. Like when you see, when you saw that, if you saw that documentary on Walmart, the, was it the high cost of low prices or something like that? At the same time, these communities were ecstatic that Walmart was coming to their town, going to bring like affordable goods and stuff. But yeah, of course, the workers are getting screwed. They're on pay, they're on food stamps and stuff like that. And I find that we need to be able to critique Walmart, but get away from the elitist side of that critique as well. And be able to say that as a corporate citizen, this is a poor functioning citizen, this is a poor citizen, but as a, but at the same time, without saying that the people who depend on the kind of low prices, then there's something wrong with our system that has forced people to go to that, places certainly. Like Walmart.
I just want to say that their prices aren't always competitively low.
Mm-hmm. But part of it too is like you can get anything there. So like if you
it's
have
also one-stop,
you have a
shop.
Family, right? And it's like you don't want to be zipping across town here and there. Yeah. You go one place
now
and
they
get
have
everything.
Food. They have everything. They have, you know.
Yeah.
Well, we got to change the way we eat. That's a different show.
Yeah. I don't know. I think we're hitting.
Yeah,
we're about there. It's about that time.
Oh, we have so sad. Dos minutos. Do you have any announcements? Next week, Complex is coming on the show to talk about the exhibit.
I love Complex.
Oh man, you're gonna miss it, man.
I can't remember the name.
It's only one Complex.
Exhibit.
Is there her the exhibit's today?
It started yesterday.
Yeah,
yesterday.
But it's up for a month, so people should go to the Glad Day bookstore and check it out.
Something else.
What?
I thought you were gonna say another venue.
No.
Yeah. No, I was there last night. It was awesome. And so that's very exciting. We'll have Complex. And Complex was on our show recently, since I've been on the show. Yeah?
Yeah, around, the film.
So,
healing.
Yes.
The healing power of Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
Been doing the film. Very busy.
Yeah.
If you, folks who don't know, the drum festival is happening, the Mutali International Drum
Festival.
Yeah, I got invited to that.
Was it
Woodbine Park?
Woodbine Park, yeah.
And
so
the
that's
beaches.
You know, when is that?
It's today.
Today and tomorrow.
Today and tomorrow.
Right. Okay, and tomorrow is important.
Yeah.
You know, and if you haven't been, which I haven't, but I know Mutadi is actually kind of like a uncle of a friend of mine. And
he's Trini.
Yeah.
Thank you for the advertisement.
You're welcome. Right.
And he practices at Radio Regent.
Yes, he does. Often, every Saturday morning, bright and early. So, yeah, definitely go check that out. It's drumming from around the world. It's not just Trini drumming. It's all over the world.
And that's called Pan.
Yeah, all type of,
like it's all type pan of. Pan flute god?
It's pan drumming. It's pan drumming.
Not pan drumming.
No. I'm saying Trini drumming is called pan.
I know.
That's really just kind of like a xylophone that you made out of an oil can. But like,
I'd like to thank Lyndon for teching for us today and the really great facial expressions he was making during our discussion. I just had to cut you off there.
Yeah, I know.
Best kind of support, because truth hurts.
So we really appreciate that.
Yeah. So I think we're going to
switch
a
to
Griffin.
Some music.
Yeah, we're going to a Griffin mix.
Is it?
For today,
you've been listening to the Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM, and we're going to some music.
Do you love the movies? So do the folks at the Carlton Cinema, located steps away from College Subway Station. Magic Lantern Carlton Cinema offers some of the best deals on entertainment in the city. Matinee prices, student prices, even $5 Tuesdays. Whether you prefer foreign art films, homegrown Canadian movies, or the latest popcorn action flick, with the 9 screens, there's always something for everyone. Check carltoncinema.ca for movie listings and showtimes.